Welcome to the James River Church Podcast. You're about to hear another inspirational message from Pastor David Lindell, Executive Ministry Pastor at James River Church. It's our prayer that this message is an encouragement and blessing to your life.
We're in the middle of a study, not just of the book of Hebrews that you'll find in the New Testament, but we have zeroed in during this fall season on Hebrews chapter 11, which is the faith chapter. That's how it's known. As we learn principles about the life of faith that strengthen our walk with God. Because here's the thing, faith is a muscle. And in the same way that you work out to physically build muscle, and if you don't exercise muscle, they atrophy, faith is the same. That if faith is not worked out, if it's neglected, it atrophies. But when you work it out, it gets stronger. And as you walk through Hebrews 11, what you're watching is you're seeing different lives of people from the pages of Scripture, and each life gives you a different insight into how faith is exercised so that your faith gets strong. And I don't know about you, but I want to have strong faith. And today, Hebrews chapter 11, we are going to be looking at the decisions of faith. The decisions of faith. As I was in line for early voting a couple of days ago, I was in line between two French teachers, which was interesting. High school French teacher and a junior high French teacher, and they were talking French in French. Back in, I don't know any French. So, but as I was, you know, hearing about, you know, French and teaching French, and they were talking about trips to Paris, it took me back in my mind to a trip that Becky and I took when we were first married. I'd always wanted to go to Europe. And so I told Becky, like, before we have kids, we should save money and use all airline miles and get over there. And so we went together before Owen was born, and we started in the south of France. And it became very apparent from the beginning of that trip that if you don't know French, it's gonna be a little difficult. If you're French and you're watching this, we love you. But it might just be a little bit easier to be a tourist in that country if some of them would maybe try to help you navigate linguistically the challenges as a tourist. And they're like, yeah, okay, we love you. Well, we are 3 days into the trip, and we got to take an early morning train to Paris. We got to take an early morning train. Actually, we're going through the Alps up into Paris. And so it was really excited about it. We had to get up at like 3:30 in the morning. And so we're in this little French town, and we had not packed like people who know how to go to Europe. We had huge suitcases, and they're like bouncing around on the streets. And it's like echoing through the town. They've got to think those are Americans. Yep, that's what's happening right there. And so we're in the train station. There's no elevator at the train station. It is 4 stories above the street. And so at 3:45 in the morning, I'm going up the staircase with the suitcases, and we get to the top, and there's a board at the top, a digital readout of the trains that are coming, and we've got our little brochure, and there's a little street light there, and it's all in French. So we have no idea what train is coming, but we know our train is coming soon. And so we've got our suitcases, and we're on the edge of that platform waiting and very excited because we're gonna go to Paris. And so, you know, you're tired, but you're like holding hands and just, you know, so romantic. And here comes around the bend, here comes the light of the train. And so we get our suit, make sure we're not missing anything. And we're waiting, and all of a sudden the train goes whoosh. It's like, no big deal, probably not our train. It's not ours. That one is not the one we are supposed to take. We're supposed to take the next one. So we sit and we wait, no train. And then all of a sudden, here comes a light. This is so exciting. This is our train. And so we step up to the platform, and we're ready to go. And then whoosh, another express, that's not our train. No, we knew that, no big deal. But the interesting part about it is that according to the French brochure we're looking at, our train should have already come. So that is a problem, because now it's 4 o'clock in the morning and we're not on a train. And so we see a little delivery truck, 4 stories down, kind of coming through the town. And I'm like, we should go talk to that guy in French. We'll be in English, but he'll understand us. Show him the brochure. And Becky goes, I'll do it. So I was like, that is awesome. Thank you, babe. I really appreciate that. And so she goes four flights down the stairs in the dark into this. Well, I can see her from up on the platform. And she's talking to the delivery driver. And he points out the window. And all of a sudden, I watch her walk across the street, go around a corner into an alley. This is not worth a train ride. I want us to survive this trip. So I walk with the luggage because I'm scared. I walk all the way down and I get to the bottom and she comes around the corner right as I get to the bottom. And she goes, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I'm coming down to find you. And she was like, no, the train's about to come. I was like, okay. So I grab the luggage and I walk back up all those flights of stairs. We're waiting. No train. Okay. The guy said the train was going to come. So I'm like, you know what? We wait. We watch our watch. No train. He said it was going to be like 5 minutes. It's not. So we're like, I said, I think we better come up or go back down and talk to that guy again. And I said, but this time you're not going by yourself. So I grab all the luggage. We go down the four flights of stairs. We get to the bottom and he goes, what are you doing? The train's coming. Oh, so that's like, we pick up the luggage. We go back up the four flights of stairs. Here's the thing. At some point, you're just going to have to make a decision to stay on the platform, everybody. Get to the top. We're sweating. We're tired. Here comes the train. Oh, please don't let it pass. Please don't let it pass. It slows down. We get on. We fall asleep. Praise the Lord. Sometimes in life, you just have to make a decision. But life is filled with decisions. Do you know that today, in America, the average American makes, every day, approximately 35,000 decisions? More decisions than people have made in human history. We're thrust into circumstances where we have to make a decision. And what cognitive scientists tell us is that what is happening is because as the amount of decisions increase, the quality of your decisions decreases, and they've labeled this phenomenon decision fatigue. This is why you can make a string of good decisions. You can decide you're going to eat healthy, and then all of a sudden one day you come home and you eat a half gallon of ice cream. You can decide you're going to save money. We're going to be on a budget, and then all of a sudden you make a silly financial purchase. You can decide, you know what? I'm going to study, and then you stay up all night and binge watch Netflix. It's cognitive fatigue. And the fact of the matter is this, when you think about all of the decisions in front of us as people, the question becomes, okay, if we've got 35,000 decisions in front of us every day, what do we do to avoid that fatigue and make good decisions through the course of our life? And I want to tell you something incredibly encouraging, that a person of faith has a massive edge when it comes to making good decisions. Why is that? Because for the person of faith, there are some things that are pre-decided when you're walking with God. And those pre-decisions in your life change the way that you process every other decision. And as we go to Hebrews 11 today, and we look at the life of Abraham and the patriarchs, we're going to see that the writer of Hebrews gives us a decision-making framework as he looks at the decisions of faith. Let's look at this in Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. He considered that God was able to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave direction concerning his bones. What we're going to see in this passage is that faith looks at life differently. Faith decides differently. And it's because faith has pre-decided three things that change the landscape of every other decision you will make. And the first is that faith has decided to obey God. Faith has decided to obey God. Look at this. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. The writer Warren Wiersbe says, faith that cannot be tested cannot be trusted. Faith that cannot be tested cannot be trusted. And this makes sense to us. Would you fly in a plane that hadn't been tested? Well, that's an easy one. No, don't do it. Would you buy a car that had not gone through any tests? No. Would you let a doctor perform surgery on you who had not been tested in medical school? No. Why? Because if it hasn't been tested, it can't be trusted. And faith that cannot be tested cannot be trusted. And the writer of Hebrews is pointing us to the biggest test of faith in the life of Abraham that he will ever, ever encounter, as he is tested concerning the promises of God. And he's referring back to Genesis chapter 22. Let's look at it. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. So much of life hinges on our willingness, our predecision to obey God. So much of you, your life, what you experience in your walk with God, hinges on the decision to obey God. And when you watch Abraham's response to what God says, there are three truths that emerge about what it looks like to really obey God. Because in the life of faith, we have to understand that obedience is a certain way in the life of faith, true obedience, real obedience. And the first of these truths that emerges that is that obedience is informed. That in the life of faith, we follow God, we obey God out of an informed obedience. When God spoke to Abraham's heart, he not only knew that what God was saying to him meant that it was the death of his son. It wasn't potentially, it was. To obey God meant the death of Isaac, but it also meant the end, seemingly, of the promises that God had made to Abraham. Because every one of the promises into the future that God had made would come through Isaac. So if Isaac is sacrificed, how do the promises come to fruition? If Isaac dies, then it seems like the promises die. And that's a problem if God is trustworthy. The scholar William Lane writes about this moment in Abraham's life by saying this: when Abraham obeyed God's mandate to leave Ur, he simply gave up his past. So Ur was his home country. But when he was summoned to Mount Moriah to deliver his own son to God, he was asked to surrender his future as well. Do you realize that when you commit to obeying God, that is the act of giving him your future? When you pre-decided that no matter what God says, no matter where God calls you, no matter what God moves you to do, it happens, it goes, because you've pre-decided to obey him, that's really giving him your future. Abraham has come face to face with the question of, not does just God take care of my past, have my past, have I surrendered my past, but have I surrendered my future? And the question is the same for you. Have you surrendered your future? Have you surrendered your future? Now, here's why this is so hard, because when it comes to the surrender of your future, just like Abraham is looking at the death of Isaac and the death of the promise, often obedience can look like death. Because there are things that you wanted to do. There are things that felt good. Some of you, you're in a marriage that's hard and God has said to stay. And it feels like death. Some of you are single and God has called you to remain single for this season, to be fully devoted to him, and it feels like death. Some of you had a dream in your heart And God said, I want you to hold on that. I want you to wait on that. And it feels a little like death. Some of you are in a job you do not like. And God has not released you to move. And it feels like death. And some of you are in a job that you love. And God is calling you to step out into the unknown and do something new. And it feels like the death of security and the death of the known. Often, obedience feels like death. But when you think about the life of Abraham, what allowed Abraham to say yes to God in this moment? You see, Abraham wasn't only tested in this moment. He's been tested before. Yet every time, when you read the story of Abraham, every time he was tested, he deviated. God said, go, deviated. God said, I'm going to give you a son. Here's how it's going to happen, deviated. And every time Abraham deviated, it didn't go well. Every time he went a little bit his own way or he got off track, it messed things up. And now Abraham, what's informed his obedience in this moment is looking back at the decisions he's made in the past and saying, okay, I went my own way there, it didn't go well. I went my own way there, things got messed up. I went my own way there, it didn't work out. And he's looking at this command from the Lord and he's saying, okay, I can look in the rearview mirror and see all the places it didn't go well, but I also can look in the rearview mirror and see every time I have decided to obey, God has been trustworthy. And every time I've decided to surrender, God has brought me to safety. And every time I have bent my knee to his will in my life, he's been faithful. Can anybody testify in this room that when you followed him wholeheartedly, he went before you and he helped you and he was good and faithful. That's informed obedience. This is where obedience starts, but it's also irreducible. That our obedience before God is meant to be irreducible. In other words, it's meant to be complete. We're not supposed to leave anything out. And this is a lesson that Abraham has learned. In fact, go back to Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. Now, when you think about this word offered up, our English doesn't really fully convey what the Greek conveys, because in the Greek, it's the Greek word prosphero. And offered up is in the perfect tense. It signifies a completed action in past time. In other words, when the writer of Hebrews says Abraham offered up, it views Abraham's offering as completed in his heart. Because if you don't know the story of Abraham offering Isaac, what happens is he gets right down to the moment when he's going to sacrifice Isaac, and the angel of the Lord stops him from sacrificing his son. So when you think about what the writer of Hebrews is saying there, you can be like, huh, well, God stopped him. He didn't actually offer him up. But God says, no, before Abraham ever got to the altar, it was done in his mind. It was a foregone conclusion that he was going to do exactly what God said. Can I ask you a question? Is it a foregone conclusion when God speaks to you that it's as good as done? Is it a foregone conclusion that if God says go this way, you go that way without even deviating? And from the moment you take the first step, you've already in your heart arrived at the destination. Because that's Abraham. Not only do we know that from the word used there, but then when you go down into verse 19, it says he considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. Why would he add that note, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back? Because it was as good as done in Abraham's mind. Isaac had already been sacrificed. It was already done because he had decided to obey without deviating for one second. This is the obedience that's been decided, not that is being decided, but that has been decided for the person of faith. Not only though is it informed, not only is it irreducible, but it's also something we say in our house, it's immediate. Immediate obedience. We always tell our kids, immediate obedience. It's not immediate. It's not really obedience. Why? Because delay and procrastination are the same as disobedience. We got parents on the front row. Same as disobedience. Delay dulls the voice of the Spirit in our lives. When you put it off, it's the same as saying, God, I'm not ready to embrace your timetable. Obedience is meant to be immediate, and that's exactly what Abraham does. Look at Genesis 22, verse 3. So Abraham rose early in the morning. If there was going to be a day to sleep in, you would have thought it would have been this day. But Abraham says, no, God spoke into my heart. I'm getting up early and I'm doing it right away. In fact, it takes Abraham less than 24 hours to do what God told him to do. And some of us listening to this know things in the back of our mind that are 24 years old. And we're still wrestling with God. If God has spoken to your heart, obey. If he said, do it, do it. If he said, give it, give it. If he said, go, take the step. Why? Because immediate obedience is real obedience. So the person of faith has decided to obey, but not only that, look at this. This is so cool. Faith has decided that God will do the impossible. A lot of Christians have decided that God might do the impossible. A lot of Christians have decided that God can do the impossible. But faith has decided that God will do the impossible. Very different for the person of faith, that God will do the impossible. So let's enter Abraham's mind here as he contemplates what God is calling him to do. As he's laying on his pillow the night before he's going to get up early to move toward the sacrifice of his son, he's facing what seems like an impossible situation. It makes no sense to him. He's struggling to wrap his mind around it. It's going to rip his heart out as it would any father. He's just, He knows he's going to obey. He just doesn't know how. God, I've said yes, you have my yes, but God, how? How am I gonna get through this decision? How am I gonna do what you've spoken to my heart? But as he thinks about it, he realizes this, that faith has decided that I'm not only going to obey no matter what, but that no matter what, I am going to see God do the impossible. Because blessing follows obedience. You want to see a miracle in your situation? It starts with obeying God. Some of you are saying, I need to see a miracle in my finances. My question is, are you tithing? Why? Because blessing follows obedience. I need to see a miracle in my kids' lives. Well, are you putting God first in every part of your family life and home? You know, I need to see a miracle in my relationship. Well, is that person the priority or is God at the top of the list? Because blessing follows obedience. Faith has decided to obey God, and that as a result of obeying God, I've got this inward confidence that God will do the impossible. God will do it. And I want you to see this in the text, because go back to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 19. He considered, that being Abraham, that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which he, figuratively speaking, did receive him back. In the NIV, it says, Abraham reasoned. Now, the problem with our English translations here is they don't adequately communicate what's happening. It makes it look like God, like Abraham's casually considering that God might do something. Well, he might raise him from the dead. You never know. He's God, I'm not. Which is the way that a lot of Christians think about their situation. Well, maybe he will. I don't know. It stands to reason. He's God, he might do that, he certainly can, certainly might. But it never rises in our hearts and minds to the level of he will. Why am I saying that it is risen to that level when these words don't communicate that? And the reason that I'm saying that is the Greek word that is used here. Listen to what David Allen writes about this Greek word. He says, it could only be sorted out in Abraham's mind that God must intend to raise Isaac from the dead. Thus, Abraham's reasoned, a word meaning inward conviction and not merely a considered opinion. In other words, this was not in the realm of opinion for Abraham. This was in the realm of God's going to do it. That's very different. God is going to do a miracle. God is going to help me. God is going to bring about a resurrection. God is going to flip the script on this because it's who he is. God is not only able, but God desires to do it. God will do it because it's who he is. That's a different perspective. That's a different orientation for the person of faith. But not only does the Greek point us to the fact that Abraham had decided what he knew God would do in his situation, we also see this in Genesis. Look at Genesis 22, because this is fascinating. When Abraham said to his young men, so these are the servants who came with him, they got to the base of the mountain, he said, stay here with the donkeys, and I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. I and the boy will come again to you. The NIV makes this even clearer. Listen to this. We will come back to you. Abraham is anticipating either a resurrection or something else he can't fathom. The writer of Hebrews says he's anticipating a resurrection. I don't know where you're at today, and I don't know what you're up against. I don't know what God has called you to obey him in, but I can tell you this, you're on solid footing on the word of God if you're anticipating God to do a miracle in your situation, because that's what the people of faith did. They didn't operate in the might or maybe or can, they operated in the will, that God will do it. This is a decision that faith has made. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 19. Why can he be there as he calculates what God is going to do? Because that word considered, that word reasoned, is a mathematical term in Greek. It means he was calculating. Abraham did the math and he decided God's going to raise him from the dead. How does the math in his head add up to a resurrection? Because look at where the math starts. He considered that God. God's first in the equation. So here's the thing. A lot of us, when we think about our situation, we start doing the math. Say, well, when I factor in my genetics, when I think about other people who've had my condition, well, and there's Uncle Fred, so I gotta add him in. And what the doctor said, great doctor, and we love our doctors, but if they're the first factor in your equation, that's not good. They're a factor in the equation. They're not the first factor in the equation. But what keeps a lot of us from going where Abraham went is that we've added up all the other factors, and then at the very end, we go, oh, yeah, and God. And we don't come up with a miracle. Shocker. Why? Because we put God at the bottom of the list instead of starting with him at the top of the list. The primary factor in the equation of your situation has always got to be the God who does the supernatural if you're going to see a miracle. And here's the thing, God wants to do a miracle in your situation. God desires to do a miracle in your situation. But instead of saying, well, he might, and instead of saying, well, he can, how about saying he's the God who calls things that are not as though they are. He is the God who will do a miracle. He's the God who will intervene. He is the God who will help me because it's who he is. And I'm standing on his word. Here's the thing. You will never plan for a miracle until your thinking starts with the God of the impossible. You will never plan for a miracle until your thinking starts with the God of the impossible. I don't know what you're thinking about today. I don't know what you're considering. I don't know what you're pondering, but maybe, just maybe, you need to take the eraser out and wipe away the old equation and start with God at the top and say, God, I've looked at this the wrong way. I've looked at my paycheck. I've looked at my lineage. I've looked at my family. I've looked at my current situation, and I've forgotten about the God who made the air I breathe and puts breath in my lungs and the beat in my heart. And if you're at the top of the list, well, that changes things. It changes things. Abraham is anticipating that God's going to do a miracle. Why? Because faith has decided God will do a miracle. Faith has decided to obey God no matter what. Faith has decided God will do a miracle. But also, and this is incredibly important, faith has decided to leave a legacy of faith has decided to leave a legacy of faith, because when you think about the way that the writer of Hebrews has structured this portion of the chapter, he starts with Abraham's decision to obey as he faces the greatest test of his entire life. And he moves from that to his decision, his pre-decision that God will do the impossible. Now he wants us to see the cascading effect that that has generationally, not just in Abraham's life, but the cascading effect that will have in any person's life who has already decided those other things. I want you to note, look at this. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 20. By faith, Isaac, generation one. This is Abraham's son. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, generation two, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. By the way, the sons of Joseph are generation four. By faith, Joseph, generation three, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. Four generations in three verses. What do all of the men in the verses that each verse starts with, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, what do they all have in common? They're all involved in action at the end of their life. This passage is about legacy. They're all making decisions and doing things that in these moments affect the next generation in front of them. Why are they doing that? And of all the things the writer of Hebrews could point out about Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, why does he point out these three moments? Because he wants to call us back to Joseph's son's great, great, great grandfather. He wants to call us back to the decisions that Abraham had made and recognize that your faith is never just about you. Your faith is never just about you. And if you see your faith as just about you or just about you and God, if that's the way you see your faith, then you'll have nothing to leave the generations that come behind you. Your faith is never just about you. The most recent data says that just over 30% of Americans have a will. A written document that gives instruction about their plans for their stuff after they die. A will is important. It's not really important because of the person who makes the will. It's important because a will says, I care about the people who are coming after me. This is a plan for their future. Some of you are thinking, well, I don't know what I'd even put in the will. I mean, I don't know what I would write down. I don't feel like I have much to leave. But just like a physical will is a plan for physical things you're going to leave behind, you can leave a spiritual will that leaves a legacy for the generations that will follow you. What do you think is more important? Do you think it's more important that you write down what's going to happen with that necklace? Or what's going to happen with your car? I can tell you what's more important. What will affect generations is not what happens with your Honda. What will affect generations is what happens with your faith. Praise God, bless the people who come behind you, but bless them primarily by making decisions today that will have a cascading effect over the course of not just one generation or two generations, but generations behind you as you leave them the decisions that marked your life. And because they marked your life, they'll mark their life. Parents, mark your life with decisions of faith. Grandparents, mark your life with decisions of faith. Who knows when Jesus is coming back? But until he does, we will decide that we are going to obey him no matter what. We are going to decide to look to him to do the miraculous in any situation because he will do miracles. And we are going to decide to leave legacies of faith. Because that legacy of faith is not going to just touch the lives of your kids, grandkids, great-grandkids, great-great-grandkids. It's going to touch the life of every person you know. You're leaving it today. You can also accelerate it today. This is the power of Abraham's story. It's not just about him. It can also be about you. If you will make the decisions of faith that will affect generations.